This is side number one of the Parables of Mercy. It doesn't. It seems to be a compilation of essays by the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of the New Evangelization, and this is in the Jubilee Year of Mercy 2015 and 16, published by our Sunday Visitor Publishing Division from Huntington, Indiana. The table of contents: there's a preface, and then chapter one is introduction and Jesus, Mary, and the parables. Chapter two: whoever is forgotten more loves more. Pardon me. Whoever is forgiven more loves more. And that, and then the two debtors and their creditor, from the Luke's Gospel, chapter 7, verses 36 to 50. Chapter 3 is compassion for a stranger, the Good Samaritan parable, from Luke chapter 10, verse 25 to 37. Chapter 4 is finding the lost sheep and the lost coin, and that's from Luke's Gospel, chapter 15, verses 1 to 10. Chapter 5 is extreme compassion, and the Merciful Father, from Luke's Gospel, chapter 15, verses 11 to 32. Chapter 6 is the opposite of mercy, the rich man and the beggar Lazarus. That's in Luke's Gospel, chapter 16, verses 19 to 31. Chapter 7 is how do we change God's mind, the judge and the widow, from Luke's Gospel, chapter 18, verses 1 to 8. Chapter 8 is who is justified by God, the Pharisee and the publican in the temple, from Luke's Gospel, chapter 18, verses 9 to 14. And the conclusion, the gospel and mercy in the parables. He begins with a preface. In Misericordiae Vultus, the papal bull proclaiming the Jubilee Year of Mercy, Pope Francis writes, "With our eyes fixed on Jesus and his merciful gaze, we experience the love of the Most Holy Trinity." End of quote. The mission Jesus received from the Father is none other than revealing the very love that gives itself to every person without excluding anyone. A quotation. Everything in him speaks of mercy. Nothing in him is devoid of compassion. That's from the Pope's encyclical. This wonderful saying can serve as an introduction for the reflections in this pastoral book as it lays out the parables of mercy. It makes for provocative reading. Delving into the parables helps us understand Jesus' teaching in them, but above all, it helps us recognize ourselves in the stories. There is probably nothing like the parables to engage readers in the existential dimensions of life that shine through them and to guide readers in making life changes. Pope Francis also invites us to perceive the overall message contained in the parables when he states, quote, "Jesus reveals the nature of God as that of a father who never gives up until he has forgiven the wrong and overcome rejection with compassion and mercy. We know these parables well, three in particular, the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the father with the two sons. In these parables, God is always presented as full of joy, especially when he pardons. In them, we find the core of the gospel and of our faith, because mercy is presented as a force that overcomes everything, filling the heart with love and bringing consolation through pardon." The end of the quote from the Pope's encyclical. The Pontifical Council for the Promotion of the New Evangelization owes thanks to Monsignor Antonio Pita for having accepted the invitation to write this commentary. His well-known competence with the Bible and his direct style provide us with a valuable tool for pastoral work. The genuine spiritual insight and remarkable cultural depth found in this commentary will be of assistance in personal reflection, catechesis, and Lectio Divina. Understanding the parables that are addressed to each of us will help us live out the Holy Year of Mercy in a way that witnesses to the faith we profess. Now, that introduction that we just read is signed by Rino Fisichella, the president of the Pontifical Council for the Promotion of the New Evangelization. He's a bishop. Chapter 1, The Introduction, Jesus, Mercy, and the Parables. Be merciful even as your Father is merciful. That's a quotation from St. Luke's Gospel, chapter 6, verse 36. That is one of Jesus' boldest statements. The Jewish people knew the fact that God, the Father, is merciful, but to think that human beings can be like him raises a problem. Can we ever be as merciful as our Father? And for what reason should we be like him? The Gospel of Mercy, which is what Luke's Gospel is called, tells the life of Jesus with mercy as its main theme. Before even talking about mercy, Jesus made us feel it and see it. One of his first miracles is for a leper. Quotation from St. Mark's Gospel, chapter 1, verse 41. Moved with pity, he stretched out his hand and touched him. Moved by compassion, Jesus is not afraid of becoming infected. The cry of the blind man in Jericho is louder for Jesus than the cry of those who try to silence him. And he quotes here, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." That's from St. Luke's Gospel, chapter 18, verse 38. His encounters with the sick and with sinners are full of mercy. Out of compassion, he frees a woman who is about to be stoned. That's in John's Gospel, chapter 8, verses 3 to 11. The way he allows himself to be touched by a sinful woman disgusts Simon the Pharisee. That's in Luke's Gospel, chapter 7, verses 36 to 50. Jesus does not speak about mercy in the abstract. Rather than defining it, he talks about it through parables. Which parables? Why use parables? For whom is the mercy in these parables, and how is it demonstrated? He divides this chapter into some sections. The first one is, which parables are about mercy? For those who are familiar with the Bible, the parables of mercy call to mind the three stories in Luke, chapter 15, verses 1 to 32, the lost sheep, the lost coin, and the prodigal son. However, the concept of mercy is also expanded in other parables of Jesus, the two debtors and their creditor, Luke's Gospel, chapter 7, verses 41 to 43, the Good Samaritan, Luke's Gospel, chapter 10, verses 25 to 37, the rich man and the beggar Lazarus, Luke's chapter 16, verses 19 to 31, the unjust judge and the persistent widow, Luke's Gospel, chapter 18, verses 1 to 8, and the Pharisee and the publican in the temple, Luke's Gospel, chapter 18, verses 9 to 14. In the third Gospel, eight of Jesus' parables deal with mercy from different angles. Seven of them are told during Jesus' journey toward Jerusalem. That's described in Luke chapter 9, verse 51, to chapter 19, verse 46. Only the short parable of the debtors and their creditor, that's in Luke 7, verses 41 to 43, is told during the time he was still preaching in Galilee. Since for much of that journey in Luke's Gospel, Jesus is telling parables of mercy, it is appropriate to examine what he says about the many aspects of mercy. Mercy is not a natural virtue that depends on a person's character. The most virtuous person is not necessarily more merciful than anyone else. Instead, mercy is a question of inner disposition that matures as one spends time with Jesus. That is how we learn mercy. Of course, not all of Jesus' parables concern mercy, and the topic of mercy is not communicated only through parables. The parables, however, deserve to be looked at separately, and the exhortation to be merciful even as your Father is merciful is the key to accessing them. Another section of this same chapter, why use parables? Why use parables to talk about mercy rather than other ways of communicating about it? And why so many parables on mercy? Why isn't the parable of the prodigal son, or the parable of the merciful father, as people today prefer to call it, enough? Charity and wisdom are praiseworthy, but we should add mercy to that list. If we really think about it, if we are supposed to be merciful like God, merciful like and because the Father is merciful, it is impossible to speak about mercy apart from the people who actually have it or are lacking it. If Jesus prefers to tell stories about mercy rather than define it, he has his reasons, which we will try to highlight. And this section is called A Mirror of Life. Jesus' parables, including those on mercy, are linked to real life and depict it. It would be a mistake to think that after having read one of his parables, we need to interpret it. The very opposite is true. The parables interpret people's lives and challenge them. The parable of the two debtors and the creditor, that's in Luke's Gospel, chapter 7, verses 41 to 43, that parable is inspired by the embarrassing situation at the home of Simon the Pharisee. Jesus lets his feet be washed and kissed by a sinful woman. The parable he tells in that episode illustrates that the debtor, who is forgiven the larger sum of money, is more grateful to his creditor than the person who has less debt to repay. If the woman washes Jesus' feet, it is because he has forgiven her sin. It is not the case that she is forgiven because she washed his feet. The three parables in Luke chapter 15, which are generally known as the parables of mercy, follow the statement that Jesus is eating with sinners. The parables bring clarity to that situation and force those who criticize Jesus to rethink their judgments. After those three parables, Jesus remarks about a person who exalts himself before God, that's in Luke chapter 16, verse 15, and they lead to his parable of the rich man and the beggar Lazarus. The parable of the judge and the persistent widow, that's in Luke chapter 18, verses 1 to 8, explains the importance of prayer. If people are persistent, they are capable of changing God's mind. The parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector in the temple, that's Luke chapter 18, verses 9 to 14, arises from the presumption of people who look down on others to exalt themselves. Jesus mirrors real life in his parables, our relationship with God and with other sinners. For this reason, the characters in the parables are anonymous, and the locations in which they act are indeterminate. All listeners become part of Jesus' parables and are mirrored there with disarming truth, causing them to rethink the relationships they participate in every day. Now a section, we're still on this same chapter, He and the Other. He and I and the Other. Real life is conveyed through Jesus' parables, and all the ones about mercy are told in terms of a three-way relationship. For convenience sake, we can refer to it as the He, I, and the Other. The scenes involve two debtors and one creditor, a priest, a Levite, and a Samaritan, a shepherd, 99 sheep, and one lost sheep, a housewife, 9 drachmas, and one lost drachma, a father of 2 sons, one of whom was dead and then returned to life, an anonymous rich man, Lazarus, and Abraham, an unjust judge, God, and a widow, a Pharisee, a tax collector, and God in the temple. Since we also find parables in the Gospels that focus on one element, like the parable about the mustard seed that grows on its own, that's in Luke chapter 13, verses 18 and 19, or the two elements, like the parable of the leaven and the dough, Luke 13, verses 20 to 21, the threefold relationship in the parables of mercy is intentional. This structure implies a message we cannot overlook. The mercy of God is often linked to the mercy displayed by human beings and does not occur in a vacuum or merely in terms of my relationship to God. Be merciful even as and because your Father is merciful. That's in Luke chapter 6, verse 36. That is the central architectural beam of mercy in parable form. Now a section called the reversal. The parables of mercy, the parables of mercy take nothing for granted and have in common a reversal of the situation. They checkmate the listeners because the situations are resolved in surpassing ways that are contrary to what would be expected. In answer to Jesus' question about which of the two debtors would love his creditor more, Simon responds, "The one, I suppose, to whom he forgives more." That's a quote from Luke chapter 7, verse 43. Without wanting to, he justifies the sinful woman who is washing Jesus' feet. At the end of the parable of the Good Samaritan, when Jesus was asked who the neighbor is, that's in Luke chapter 10, verse 29, the answer obliges the lawyer to make himself everyone's neighbor and to imitate the person who had compassion on the dying man. That's from verse 37. Contrary to normal logic, the shepherd leaves 99 sheep in the desert to go look for the missing one and risks becoming a shepherd who has no flock at all. That's in Luke chapter 15, verses 3 to 7. The parable of the merciful father is shocking because he reverses the situation of the sons. For the younger son who asks to be treated like one of the hired servants, the father reconfers the dignity of being a son. However, facing the older son who condemns his brother with his dismissive phrase, "This son of yours," that's Luke chapter 15, verse 30, the father inverts his phrase with, "This your brother," Luke 15, verse 32. The reversal concerning the rich man and Lazarus is puzzling. The former has enjoyed good things in his life, in this life, but the latter is now comforted for all eternity. That's in Luke chapter 16, verse 25. If an unjust judge grants the request of a widow after a long time, then God immediately grants the request of his chosen. That's in Luke chapter 18, verse 7 and 8. The reversal that occurs between the Pharisee and the publican in the temple is unimaginable. The former prays a long time and lists all his good works, but is not justified. The latter recognizes he is a sinner and goes home justified without performing any sacrifice for the expression of his sin, of expiation of his sins. That's in Luke chapter 18, verse 14. All of this is upside down, like an inverted pyramid. The parables of mercy catch the hearers off guard because God's action in them reverses every kind of firm certainty people have and forces them to reconsider their way of thinking about God and of envisioning Jesus. Now he begins a section in this same chapter entitled Mercy Seen from the Inside. The issue of mercy is a heart issue, which should not, however, be confused with sentimentalism. In the Bible, the heart is the seat of thought, the center from which people's most intimate decisions are made. For this reason, to have compassion or mercy is the equivalent of inner visceral impulse that connects someone to the other. If we exclude the shorter parables, the two debtors, the rescued sheep, the recovered drachma, the turning point in the more fully articulated parables occurs in the human heart. Compassion for the dying man, which the priest and the Levite do not have, is found in a Samaritan man. Quote, when he saw him, he had compassion. That's from Luke chapter 10, verse 33. Compassion puts wings on the feet of the merciful Father. Quote, while he, the younger son, was yet at a distance, he had compassion. That's in Luke chapter 15, verse 20. Even though the younger son is suffering from hunger, if he had not come to his senses, he would not have taken the road back home. It is only when the unjust judge talks to himself that he decides to give the widow justice. See Luke chapter 18, verses 4 and 5. The Pharisee's arrogant prayer is in contrast to the tax collector's prayer. Quote, God be merciful to me, a sinner. That's from Luke chapter 18, verse 13. The beauty in the parables of mercy is reflected in a human heart laid bare and is uncovered in the depth of compassion demonstrated towards one's neighbor. Since it is poles apart from cheap mercy, it is a mercy that generates passion among human beings and can be compared to God's. There is no mercy when people lack the willingness to look within themselves. All that remains is the luxury of a rich man clothed in purple and expensive linen, but incapable of seeing poor Lazarus, who lies neglected in front of the large entrance to his house. He refers to Luke's Gospel, chapter 16, verses 19 to 20. Now, another section in this same introductory chapter is entitled, For Whom Are the Parables of Mercy? God's mercy is for everyone, but it is also for very specific people. The parables involve two categories of people, those in the parables and those who hear them. The parable of the two debtors pardoned by their creditor, for example, also involves Jesus, Simon, and the sinful woman because of the context in which it is told. If at the beginning of the parable of the Good Samaritan, the dying man is the object of compassion, in the end, the neighbor is the very Samaritan himself, so the lawyer is being exhorted to become a neighbor to the other. Sinners correspond to the lost sheep and the missing drachma, while the Pharisees and the scribes seem to share the lot of the 99 sheep left in the desert and the 9 drachmas that are still safe and secure, but not really. The parable of the merciful Father is filled with the Father's compassion for one son and his entreaty of the other son. This time it is not so easy to convince the Pharisees and the scribes about mercy, since the sons are not as innocent as the sheep and the coin. The poor man, Lazarus, is carried by angels to Abraham's bosom, but the rich man is not granted any of his requests. People who are attached to money should not deceive themselves that their opulent lifestyle continues into the afterlife. If the widow is the recipient of mercy, the unjust judge grants her, how much more does God... If the widow is the recipient of mercy, the unjust judge grants her, how much more does God listen to his chosen ones? A tax collector who admits he is a sinner is justified, but not the Pharisee who exalts himself. Whoever exalts himself by scorning others has something to think about in the face of such a scathing parable. The range of sinners in the parables is not dictated by populism or to imply a social revolution, but is presented because Jesus wants to implicate all his listeners. Otherwise, it might be easy to have mercy for only a few people if mercy is in fact based on merit and not grace. The bridge tying the first and the last parable of mercy together is notable. The first parable is told in the house of Simon the Pharisee when a sinner washes Jesus' feet. That's in Luke chapter 7, verses 41 to 43. And the last parable presents a Pharisee and a tax collector who realizes he is a sinner. That's in Luke chapter 18, verses 9 to 14. The parables of mercy do not leave people untouched. They involve the listeners profoundly and bring them into the story. Now we begin chapter 2. Whoever is forgiven more loves more. And this concerns the two debtors parable and the creditor, which is in Luke chapter 7, verses 36 to 50. The short parable told in Luke 7, 41 to 43, sheds light on distinct situations in Jesus' public life. He visits with sinful men and women, and even assumes to himself the right to forgive their sins. This is a prerogative that for the Jews of that time belongs only to God and is regulated by the priests in the temple. This parable is told while Jesus is at dinner in the house of Simon the Pharisee. Because of its beauty, the parable deserves to be seen in the context in which it is told. And now he quotes the Bible here. That's Luke chapter 7, verses 36 to 50. And here's the quote, here's the biblical passage. One of the Pharisees asked him to eat with him, and he went into the Pharisee's house and sat at table. And behold, a woman of the city who was a sinner, when she learned that he was sitting at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of ointment, and standing behind him at his feet, weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears, and wiped them with the hair of her head, and kissed his feet, and anointed them with the ointment. Now when the Pharisee who had invited him saw it, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would have known who and what sort of woman this is who is touching him, for she is a sinner." And Jesus, answering, said to him, "Simon, I have something to say to you." And he answered, "What is it, teacher?" And Jesus replies, "A certain creditor had two debtors. One owed 500 denarii, and the other 50. When they could not pay, he forgave them both. Now which of them will love him more?" Simon answered, "The one, I suppose, to whom he forgave more." And Jesus said to him, "You have judged rightly." Then turning toward the woman, he said to Simon, "Do you see this woman? I entered your house, and you gave me no water for my feet, but she has wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not ceased to kiss my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Therefore, I tell you, her sins, which are many, are forgiven. For she loved much, but he who is forgiven little loves little." And he said to her, "Your sins are forgiven." Then those who were at table with him began to say among themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" And he said to the woman, "Your faith has saved you. Go in peace." That's the end of that section. And now he begins a section called Embarrassing Love. The hospitality that Jesus received in the house of Simon the Pharisee is one of embarrassing intimacy. The event involves an ordinary dinner invitation Jesus willingly accepts. During the meal, a woman arrives who is known in that area for her bad reputation. Without having been invited or having asked permission from anyone, she approaches Jesus, bathes his feet with her tears, wipes them with her hair, kisses his feet, and pours perfume over them. Her actions are shocking because she is a sinner, and Simon immediately labeled her as such. Nevertheless, Simon's attention is not focused on the sinner, but on Jesus. How can someone who is considered a prophet let his feet be washed this way? Therefore, the person under judgment here is not the woman, quickly assessed as a sinner, but Jesus, who is defiled by her sin because he let her touch him. The sinful woman performs certain actions that bewilder Simon and his guests. With her hands, her tears, and her hair, she defiles Jesus. How can someone ever communicate such a scandalous gospel? Only a parable can help us understand why Jesus is provoking such a scandal. Now he begins another section entitled The Two Debtors and Their Creditor. Jesus' passion for sinners is very humane and gratuitous without an ulterior motive. This short parable clarifies what is occurring in Simon's house. As short as it is nevertheless incisive and hits the mark well. Not to reveal the implication of the parable as it relates to the current situation all at once, he tells the story of the two debtors and their creditor. As usual, Jesus does not name these people, but focuses on the central issue of the story. The creditor is owed 500 denarii by the first debtor and 50 by the other. The disproportion is noteworthy because 50 denarii owed by the second debtor are multiplied by 10 for the first debtor. To put this in context, 50 denarii would represent about 2 months' worth of work, while 500 would be equivalent of 2.5 years of earned income. Jesus makes clear that the two debtors cannot repay the sums they owe and are pardoned by their creditor. The characters in the parable do not speak. There is no dialogue between the debtors and their creditor. All the attention is on the word forgave, which indicates the pardon for the debtors. And it is the creditor's gracious pardon that generates Jesus' question to Simon about which debtor will love the creditor more. Simon is still not aware that he is a party in the case, and he answers that the debtor who had more debt canceled would love the creditor more. His answer unmasks him and incriminates him. Had he been more attentive to the parable, he would have remembered that since any kind of sin is a debt that has been incurred, only grace can make up for the debt everyone owes God. Simon clearly seems unable to overcome the emotional shock of the grace that Jesus grants the sinful woman. A third section of this same chapter is entitled, He Who is Forgiven Little Loves Little. That's from verse 47. This parable moves off center stage for Jesus to reveal the actual situation. Simon is like the debtor who owes 2 months' pay, and for that reason did not give Jesus any water for his feet, or greet him with a kiss, or anoint his head. The sinful woman is like the debtor who owed 2.5 years of salary. She would never succeed in paying off the debt. The only way out for both of them is grace. The parable's major impact on the situation concerns the relationship between the remission of sins and the love of the sinful woman. Unfortunately, some translations render the sentence in verse 47 as, Her sins are forgiven because she has loved much. That's the end of quote. However, the original Greek expresses the consequences of the forgiveness of sin, and he quotes here, Her sins are forgiven, and therefore she has loved much. End of quote. If such great guilt had not been forgiven, she would not have been so disposed to love. The woman is able to love because she has been given unconditional grace. The second part of Jesus' answer confirms the primacy of grace. Quote, He who is forgiven little loves little. End of quote. That's verse 47. This assertion links the parable to real life. Whoever has not been reached by God's freely given love is not in a position to love him. Another section of this parable, of this chapter, the remission of sins and the faith that saves. During this meal, Jesus scandalizes all the guests who murmur among themselves, "Who is this who even forgives sins?" That's verse 49. The question calls for the most logical answer, which is the only one God can, The question calls for the most logical answer, which is that only God can forgive sins. And he refers to Luke chapter 5, verse 21. And while God can forgive sins, it is obligatory to expiate them according to the law. Jesus is appropriating a divine, not a human, right to himself. So this is an abuse on his power in the guest's mind. Nevertheless, this very abuse bridges the gap between the parable and the encounter in Simon's house. With the power to forgive the sins of a sinful woman, Jesus is in tune with God's way of acting. He forgives her because he recognizes the faith the sinful woman had right from the beginning in his power to forgive sins. If on hearing Jesus was at Simon's house, she ran to buy costly perfume and overcame whatever obstacle there was to seeing him, it is because she has an unshakable confidence that Jesus is able to forgive sins, like the creditor who forgave the one who owed 500 denarii. Faith is the only condition that Jesus asks of someone to be saved. It is even the common denominator in all his miracles. In this regard, there's a similarity between forgiving the sins of a sinful woman and the healing of a paralytic or a blind man. In the healing events as well, it is faith that saves, not the miracle itself. Now, another section of this chapter was entitled, "What is the implication for the community?" Pardon me. Let us look at the parable of the merciful king in Matthew chapter 18, verses 23 to 35. As in the parable in Luke chapter 7, verse 41 to 43, there is a creditor, the king, and two debtors, servants. The first servant owes 10,000 talents to the king, but his pleading arouses the compassion of the king, who forgives him his debt. Unfortunately, the servant hardly leaves the palace when he meets another servant who owes him 100 denarii. He deals with him harshly and has him thrown into prison. The disproportion of the debts is incalculable. If in Jesus' time one talent was the equivalent of 10,000 denarii, then 10,000 talents is an inconceivable sum with respect to 100 denarii owed by the second servant. Practically speaking, the second servant could have discharged his debt with less than 6 months' worth of work, while the first servant would have never repaid his debt to the king. The grace this first servant received from the king was wasted. The king informed him of what happened to the other servant, condemns him, quote, "You wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me, and should you not have had mercy on your fellow servant as I had mercy on you?" This is a quote from Matthew chapter 18, verses 32 to 33. As the servant is turned over to the jailers until he can repay a debt that is impossible to pay, even if he worked for the rest of his life, the conclusion of the parable is dramatic. Quote, "So also my heavenly Father will do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother from your heart." That's a quotation from St. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 18, verse 35. The church consists of servants to whom an immeasurable debt has been forgiven so that they are able to forgive other servants. What if a church, having been commanded to forgive 70 times 7, or forever, he refers to Matthew chapter 18, verses 21 to 22, if that church placed conditions on the mercy of God? Would it be capable of recognizing that God's mercy is greater than any human sin, and that mercy should never be considered a right for some, but only giving possibly guarantee? And that mercy should never be considered a right for some, but only something possibly granted to others? With Jesus, God's mercy allows itself to be contaminated by human misery, but he redeems that misery by transforming it through gratuitous, unconditional love. There is no episode in the Gospels that is more intimate than this one in Simon's house. A sinful woman touches Jesus' feet, washes them with her tears, wipes them with her hair, and kisses him with her lips. According to the Gospels, Jesus never conceded this intimacy to anyone, not even his own mother. Jesus' mercy redeems human misery not by merely brushing up against it or by merely barely touching it, but by letting himself be contaminated by it. Chapter 3, Compassion for a Stranger. The Parable of the Good Samaritan from Luke's Gospel, chapter 10, verses 25 to 37. The parable of the Good Samaritan is one of Jesus' most provocative parables. He had just set out on his journey to Jerusalem with his disciples. He encounters a lawyer with whom he dialogues about how to inherit eternal life. The lawyer is trying to test him on one of the most debated questions of the day. What is the most important commandment of the law on which eternal life depends? The situation inspires the parable of the Good Samaritan, which unravels the intricate relationship between the law and its central core. And here he begins quoting from the Bible, from Luke's Gospel, chapter 10, verses 25 to 37. And behold, a lawyer stood up to him to put the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And he said to them, "What is written in the law? What do you read there?" And he answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, "You have answered right. Do this, and you will live." But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Jesus replied, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers, who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion, and went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own beast and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, 'Take care of him, and whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back.' Which of these three do you think proved neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers?" He said, "The one who showed mercy on him." And Jesus said to him, "Go and do likewise." And now he begins a section called the Most Important Commandment. In the Palestine of Jesus' time, it seems there was a debate among the various religious groups on two key questions about the law of Moses. Which commandment is the most important, and who is the neighbor people are called to love? The multiplication of laws made it necessary to come to an essential synthesis of the law to discover its core. On the other side of the scale, with political tensions among the various groups, including the Samaritans, people were asking who was defined as their neighbor. Was it only the people who shared a faith in one God, including even a Samaritan? although the lawyer's second question is loaded because he's trying to have Jesus fall into a trap, he does reflect how much this issue was being debated by the different groups in Palestine. The first part of the dialogue takes on the first question. In terms of the multiplication of laws, the lawyer and Jesus both agree that love for God and for neighbor are necessary conditions for inheriting eternal life. The lawyer, in his answer, refers to passages in Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 5, and in Leviticus chapter 19, verse 18, to link love for God with love for neighbor. At this point, the lawyer lays a more insidious trap. Who is the neighbor people should love? A brother, an acquaintance, a friend, a stranger, or even an enemy? Can people consider someone who ignores love for God as their neighbor? In his teaching strategy on this parable, Jesus combines the two major commandments by speaking of love of neighbor in a way that implies love for God without speaking of it directly. This section is called The Priest and the Levite and the Samaritan. As usual, the people in the parable are anonymous, but Jesus does focus attention on their religious and ethnic identities. Jesus starts the story off in a distant location. He has not yet reached Jericho in his journey toward Jerusalem, and he speaks about a man who was going down from the holy city to Jericho. The road connecting the two cities was more than 16 miles long, and was dangerous because it crossed the Wadi Kelt. And there's a footnote on that. The Wadi Kelt is a valley that runs west to east across the Judean desert. It originates near Jerusalem and ends near Jericho. Back to the text. While Jerusalem is at 2,461 feet above sea level, Jericho is about 1,312 feet below sea level. So it is necessary to go down from Jerusalem to reach Jericho, just as the parable recounts. Jesus says that some bandits rob a man and leave him half dead. The dying man's condition is the sensitive issue in the parable. Can someone be in contact with a dying man without risking defilement? It is not by chance that the three people who are selected in the parable are involved in the worship of the one God in various ways. A priest who is coming down from Jerusalem after performing his temple service, a Levite who belongs to the priestly caste but does not perform temple service, and a Samaritan. And here things start not to add up, because the normal triad should include a priest, a Levite, and an Israelite. And he refers here to Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 1, and chapter 27, verse 9. The Samaritan is the odd man in the triad, because according to Jewish thinking, he is unclean and is considered a foreigner. The main reason for the friction between the two nations emerges in the dialogue Jesus has with the Samaritan woman. On which mountain should people worship God? On the mountain in Jerusalem or the Mount Gerizim, where the Samaritans worship? And he refers here to John's Gospel, chapter 4, verse 20. According to Mosaic law, whoever touches a cadaver is unclean for a week. If someone becomes contaminated and then performs a ritual action, he is to be excluded from Israel. And here he refers to the book of Numbers, chapters 19, verses 11 to 13. The rule applies even more so for a priest, and even in the case of one of his relatives who has died. And here he refers to Leviticus, chapter 21, verses 1 to 4. So this situation involves pre-existing boundaries. The priest and the Levite are faced with the alternative of observing the laws of ritual purity or of helping a dying man. However, it is good to point out that the cultural norms do not excuse the priest or the Levite, because in a situation like the one in the parable, they are also obliged to help the dying man. Instead, both of them see him and pass by. Finally, a Samaritan sees the dying man. He feels compassion for him and takes care of him. So the parable creates an untenable contrast. What the priest and the Levite avoid doing is done by a Samaritan, who is an enemy. The content of the parable begins to be provocative, since love for God does not automatically guarantee love for a neighbor. In addition, what would be expected from those who know more about the love of God, the priest and the Levite, is accomplished by someone who is defined only by his ethnic difference. The dying man is rescued by a foreigner. The third, he has another section now called From Compassion to Care. The parable reaches its turning point when it states that the Samaritan had compassion. That's in verse 33. Okay, compassion on the dying man. So at the end, the lawyer recognizes that the neighbor is the one who showed mercy on him. That's in verse 37. It is worth noting here that the verb expressing the Samaritan's compassion, and he quotes the, he mentions the Greek word splanchinozomai, which means to have compassion, derives from the noun splanchina, which in Greek means bowels, including the heart. According to the common way of thinking in Jesus' time, a person's sentiments, love, compassion, mercy, are expressed viscerally. The Samaritan does not stop at merely seeing the dying man, but becomes involved in his innermost self, and it is such visceral compassion that sets in motion the possibility of saving the dying man. True compassion is not feeling, but an action that results in caring for the other. Jesus recounts the help the Samaritan gives the dying man with attention to the specific details. He approaches him, he cleans him up, he binds up his wounds, he sets him on his mount, he takes him to the inn, he takes care of him there. And after the man lives through the first night, when there is the most risk of his dying, the Samaritan then gives the innkeeper 2 denarii, the equivalent of 2 days' wages. And when he leaves to continue his journey, he guarantees the innkeeper that if there are other expenses, he will repay him on his return. From the beginning to the end, there are no details about the dying man. He is not described in terms of his origin or his social status. All the attention is on the one who is taking care of him, paying for him. True compassion leads a person to become involved in doing good and to succeed, despite the cost of time and money, on behalf of the one who is helped. St. Ambrose of Milan says it well, and he quotes, "Mercy, not kinship, makes someone a neighbor." And this is from St. Ambrose's exposition of the Gospel of Luke, verse 7 and 84. Now begins a section called The Reversal. Jesus responds to the lawyer's question with the parable of the Good Samaritan. The parable sheds light on life by overturning a common way of thinking. In terms of the debates that were current in Jesus' time, we note that the one concerning the identity of the neighbor was among the most heated. Every group had a different way of understanding who the neighbor was supposed to be. Jesus offers the most original response because of what he recounts in the parable. He turns the debate upside down. If at the beginning the neighbor is the dying man, in the end, he is the Samaritan. The dying man is the answer to the lawyer's question, "Who is my neighbor?" But the Samaritan is the answer to Jesus' question, "Which of these three do you think proved the neighbor to the man?" The lawyer still does not realize that he is about to become a party to the case. He recognizes with searing truth that the neighbor is no longer the dying man, but the one who had compassion on him. He is thus forced to give an answer that he does not want to give. The neighbor is a Samaritan, whom the lawyer only refers to as the one who, rather than referring to his ethnic identity. Jesus reveals to the lawyer how the parable connects to life. He exhorts him to enter into the logic of the parable, like a reader entering into a story, and to act like the Samaritan by making himself the neighbor of another. Based on the first question in the dialogue about the greatest commandment, the question about who the neighbor is leads to a debate that has no resolution until people can point to themselves. The parable transforms the common mode of thinking about who the neighbor is by requiring the hearers to start with themselves. A neighbor is not to be defined by religious, cultural, or social origins, but by the compassion for the other. A section now called Jesus the Good Samaritan. Since the time of the fathers of the church, this parable has been read as depicting Jesus' human traits. St. Clement of Alexandria comments, "Who, more than he, Jesus, has pitied us, who by the rulers of darkness were all put to death with many wounds, fears, lusts, passions, pains, deceits, pleasures. Of these wounds the only physician is Jesus, who cuts out the passions thoroughly by the root." And this is a quotation from St. Clement's essay, "Who is the rich man that shall be saved?" And that's in section 29 of that essay. Different details of the parable can make us think of Jesus, who, among other things, stopped to dialogue with the Samaritan woman. That's in John's Gospel, chapter 4, verses 7 and following. Such deep compassion that is capable of transforming itself into caring for the sick is typical of Jesus. Even the secondary details, like that of the Good Samaritan leaving the inn and returning later, can make us think of a parable with Jesus leaving after his resurrection and returning at his second coming. Nevertheless, interpreting the parable as referring only to Jesus would impoverish it. What is said of the Samaritan applies to Jesus and to the Christian community, where dedication to one's neighbor is transformed into attentive care for whatever person is recognized as the other. Therefore, the parable portrays everyone's daily life and transforms it from within. It clarifies for the lawyer that love for God cannot be separated from love for neighbor. And now a section in this same chapter entitled The Fulfillment of the Law. The early Christian communities followed the trajectory of Jesus' path and deepened the significance of the parable of the Good Samaritan. On two occasions, St. Paul refers to the debate about the most important commandment in the law. He says to the Galatians, who risked devouring each other, the quotation, "The whole law is fulfilled in one word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself." That's a quotation from the Epistle to the Galatians, chapter 5, verse 14. Christian freedom is absolute because it is a gift from Christ. And he quotes Galatians, chapter 5, verse 1. For freedom, Christ has set us free. This is the reason such freedom should not lead to anarchy, but should incarnate itself in love and service of one's neighbor. When Paul then addresses the Christians in Rome, he turns to the commandment of love and considers it the unique debt that believers should have, since to some extent people are always lacking in love. And he refers to the epistle to the Romans, chapter 13, verse 9. On both occasions, Paul does not mention love for God, but focuses his attention on love for one's neighbor. Why does there seem to be such a clear imbalance and silence about love for God? The reason is given in the first letter of John, and he quotes here, "He who does not love his brother, whom he has seen, cannot love God, whom he has not seen." That's from the first letter of John, chapter 4, verse 20. The great risk that Paul and John foresee is that in the name of love for God, serious abuses and omissions could occur in the church. People's perception of their own love for God is easy to tailor to their own standards and needs, but it is a different matter when it comes to actually loving a flesh and blood neighbor. Love for God does not automatically produce love for neighbor in all cases, but it is true that love for one's neighbor is a mirror of love for God. Nevertheless, so as not to delude one ourselves, it is helpful to go back to the source, which is the love God has for us. St. John specifies, "We love because he first loved us." That's a quotation from the first letter of John, chapter 4, verse 19. To the extent that we have received the love of God, to that extent we are in the position to love our neighbor. Genuine love of neighbor does not come from social projects or simple altruism. Rather, it comes from the love that God and Jesus Christ have for human beings, and that love in turn evokes the fervor of leading people to live no longer for themselves, but for him who, for their sake, died and was raised. That's a quotation from the second letter to the Corinthians, chapter 5, verse 15. The parable of the Good Samaritan gives meaning to human life. We become a neighbor to the other, ultimately because God drew near to us and continues, through Christ, to be concerned about our human wounds. That kind of reversal draws the lawyer in and obliges him to change his mind. It is not a question of choosing between love for God and love for neighbor, but of recognizing that people who love a brother or a sister they see also love God, whom they do not see. However, it is a bitter reality of human life that the reverse is not always the case. Love of God does not automatically imply love of neighbor. Love for God, however, is always operative in love for the other. This is the end of side number one, continuing on side number two.